Hi, my name is Chris, and I apologize. I overcommitted myself, so this is going to be a very short lecture. Yeah, I know, too bad. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about clinical trials, and I don't know how many of you guys plan on is this too loud? Is this echoing? No? Plan on going to pharma or are interested in doing clinical trials. And unfortunately, my slides that I had made earlier isn't showing. I couldn't get it to work, but I'll just tell you a little bit about it. In terms of clinical trials that make it into something called a BLA or an NDA, meaning that it can go into market from preclinical all the way to phase three of a clinical trial is actually 10%. And this was in a publication that was, and it's not in the reading or in the PowerPoint deck, and I'll send you the new updated deck later. And in fact, if you look at how much pharma companies spend on getting these clinical trials and getting the drug product to you, it's close to $55 billion. So the idea that, you know, when you look at the per cost or the COGS of a drug that you take, you know, for example, Tylenol or anything else, even the immunotherapies, and you go, well, why does it cost $500? Why does it cost $1,000 per pill? When you look at the actual individual components, you know, it's like 50 cents. And the reason why is, of course, it's the willingness to pay, meaning that in the U.S., people are willing to pay that. But it's also the R&D cost to develop that drug as well. So I'm going to skip through a bunch of slides and go straight into clinical trials and the phases. So this is very important, and I think I have one question on the test, and I'll let you guys know exactly what I'll be asking, or, you know, because of the abbreviated time. Clinical trials are made up of distinct parts called phases. Phase one, clinical trials are used to show that a new treatment is safe for a small group of people. So this is what we call safety. Phase two, clinical trials provide more information about the safety of the new treatment and how well it works to treat cancer. In this case, these are cancer clinical trials, and that's efficacy. And then phase three clinical trials compare the new treatment with a standard treatment in a large group of people. And there is a phase four, but don't worry about it. That's following, after the drug is commercialized, they do post-market analysis to make sure that the drug itself, everything's okay. So how do you actually get these drugs to market? Now, there's something called an IND, an Investigational New Drug Application, and this is through the FDA. Depending on what type of drug, if it's a biologic, it's through CBER, through the FDA, and if it's an actual drug, it's through CDER. And don't worry about that, that's nomenclature, but I just wanted you to be aware of that. And then within an IND, and in cell therapy or any type of cellular product, there's something called a CMC section. And I think this is what you guys might be interested in. This is your research, and how do you get that research that you're doing on your lab benchtop into the clinic? And this is how. The FDA requires that in the CMC section, product manufacturing characterization information be described, and what that includes is the product type, derivation, where it was processed, relevant accreditation, such as FACT, which is the foundation for the accreditation of cellular therapy, CAP, CLIA, these are all accrediting agencies, and some facilities, and these are specialized laboratories. So imagine that you have Tylenol, or even meat. Believe it or not, they both follow regulations called GMP, or Good Manufacturing Practices. Now, a Type 5 master file is something that you file with the FDA, specifically giving them information about all the procedures, processes, quality management that's being performed to maintain that facility in good standing. And then what the FDA can do is anytime you manufacture a drug there, or new investigator, sponsor, manufactures a drug in that special clean room, good manufacturing practice facility, they can reference that master file, so that way you don't have to duplicate or redo the documentation. But don't worry about that. You also have to worry about procurement, starting material of the drug, and in this case for cellular therapy, it's usually an apheresis product, apheresis, UCV is umbilical cord blood, or marrow aspirate. Where was it collected? Was it collected in a apheresis laboratory? Was it collected in a bone marrow surgical suite? And then you have to describe the process. So the other thing is when you're working in cellular immunotherapy, and as you guys know, there's a lot of different types of immunotherapies, antibodies, small molecules. And in this case, for cellular immunotherapies, because it's your own blood, you have to do testing of this blood in terms of is it suitable. And these are under GTP, or good tissue practices, which is different than GMP, good manufacturing practices. And with that, you need donor suitability per GTP. That's a regulation under the Code of Federal Regulations. So this is law. Medical history, list of testing, quarantine and positive results. So let's say you have a blood product that you want to manufacture your immunotherapy or gene therapy drug. Let's say it tests positive for bacteria or mycoplasma. You actually have to quarantine this drug if it's positive. Doesn't mean you can't use it, but you do have to analyze it and see if you can still use it. Perhaps you could give the patient some type of antibiotics in addition to this to recover or to help the process along. And cell processing. So when you look at cellular immunotherapy drugs, I lied, we're going to go back to the slide after all. So one of the first cellular drugs made here at Roswell Park is a dendritic cell vaccine. So essentially what we did is we took an apheresis product from a patient, then we fractionated this product using a machine called an Elutra. And what that machine does is it fractionates the monocyte fraction. And that's described by looking at CD14. And once you get this monocyte fraction, and many of you guys probably have done this in the research laboratory, you add cytokines to it, and then you get a dendritic cell. And once you get this dendritic cell, in our case, we use the flow to analyze, to identify it, and we use CD80, CD86, CD83, and of course CD14 negative or low. And once you have this dendritic cell, you pulse it with an antigen. In this case, we used NY-ESO, was a specific tumor antigen. And this clinical trial specifically was for all solid tumors. Once we had the dendritic cell, we gave it into an infusionist. It's actually an injection because it's 10 million cells. And then we injected it into the lymph nodes. So this is what I want to talk about, manufacturing. When you manufacture the process or the product, it's not trivial. Again, going back to GMP regulations, the FDA requires that you have a clean room. So if you were to make a drug in your garage and you were to test it, and it came back negative and it's efficacious, it's everything that you want to be in terms of purity, safety, quality, identity, potency, meets requirements, it's still, the FDA still considers it adulterated. The reason why is they don't care about that final product. They care about the process that it took to actually make that drug. And this way, they know that throughout the process that you're making it right under good manufacturing practices. In this case, with our DC vaccine trial, exactly as I discussed, we did an elutriation. We took an apheresis product, elutriated the product. Then we actually used bags and not these little petri dishes. Once we had the monocytes, we added IL-4 GM-CSF. And again, this is all within a biologic safety cabinet right here at Roswell Park. And then once we had the immature dendritic cells, we matured them with these agents here, reagents here. Then once we matured them, we added the antigen, and then we injected it into the patient. So we treated 18 patients in this clinical trial, and we completed this in 2014, and we're still analyzing the results. So, do you just care if it is, in terms of potency, in terms of identity, is all very important. But when you're doing these type of clinical trials, you really want to keep make sure that the patient is safe and you're not doing any harm. So there's rigorous testing that has to be done. And we actually do it here in the GMP in the QC lab, which I run in the GMP facility as well. And we look at sterility testing, and don't worry about the specific type of sterility testing, but we look for mycoplasma, endotoxin, bacterial contamination. And we perform Gram stains for quick tests. And we also perform long-term cultures, 14 and 21-day cultures for fungus, bacteria. And this way, we can really differentiate fast-growing bacteria and slow-growing bacteria. And of course, we have to do IDMs if it's an allo, meaning that if the donor, and in this case, it was always the same auto, but in other cases, as you've probably read in the literature, they actually have immunotherapy, cellular immunotherapy, where it's a different person actually donating their cells to make the, for example, engineered T cells, and then giving it. So it truly is an off-the-shelf product. And in fact, Dr. Fumito Ito, I don't know if you know him, he's a faculty member in the Center for Immunotherapy, and he actually takes iPS cells and then makes them into T cells and then uses them for immunotherapy type experiments in mice. So identity in terms of figuring out, making sure that the product that you have is really the product that you want. Purity, as I said, and this is all under SQIPS, S-Q-I-P-P-S. Purity is the final suspension. Make sure that it really is what you expect it to be, not just a mixture of different types of cells, which it can be. Potency. So potency isn't required for all phases of a clinical trial, believe it or not. And the reason why is for phase one, as you saw earlier, it really is about safety. So in that case, we're not looking at efficacy for that clinical trial. We more care about keeping whatever we inject into the patient will be safe. And then, of course, we also do additional testing, such as viability, cell dose, how many cells are we adding to the patient, and then we have to retain an aliquot of these cell products. In order to do testing in the future, in case something happens. And in fact, I'm going to talk about this. One of the first cellular gene therapy trials in the U.S., I don't know if you guys knew this or not, was for a disease called Bubble Boy disease. Has anybody heard of that? In fact, they've had several movies. They've had a Seinfeld, or I might have just aged myself. I don't know if you guys know what Seinfeld is. But they had a whole episode on that. So they don't have an immune system. So what they were able to do is they took stem cells, they genetically modified these stem cells by adding a gamma retroviral vector that produces the ADA gene. And then once you take this retroviral vector with the ADA gene present, the transfer vector present, you mix these cells together, and then you put the stem cells back into the patient. And it actually worked. They were able to cure some kids doing this. This was back in 2000, between 2000 and 2010. And I believe they formed a company now selling this, even though it's a rare disease, a 1 in 200,000 patients. In terms of product release criteria testing, and again, with cellular immunotherapies, it's a drug. So with this drug, you have to have something called a certificate of analysis with the proper testing. And some of these release criteria are endotoxin, viability, and of course flow cytometry for viability, like 7-AAD. And they also look at sterility and other types of tests. And one of the other things the FDA really looks at when you're getting these drugs into market, and cellular drugs, is drugs in general, how stable is it? How long will it last on the shelf? And this never, as scientists, it probably doesn't occur. I mean, I never really thought of supply chain or cold chain, but when you're taking these drugs into market, it's very important. You know, if you have something that only lasts 2 hours, it's great for an academic institute. But if you really want to market this, it needs to have a longer shelf life than that. So this is something that they really look at in pharma and biotech. So product stability is very important as well. Other issues, product tracking, labeling. And this is just an example. You don't have to, it's not going to be on the test, you don't have to remember it. And there is an inhalable insulin developed by mankind. This was back in the mid-2000s. And they actually, in their clinical trials, they did phase, all the way to phase three, they found that it was better than injectable insulin. Their results were better than injectable insulin. But they never went to market. So even though the drug worked well, it didn't go to market because of labeling issues. They basically had, I mean, it's an inhalable drug, so it's understandable, but because of that, so a lot of times drugs don't go to market. It might not be because they don't work. It could be because, like with mankind, labeling or some other issue. Or maybe there's not enough, a large enough market for this drug to make a profit. But you can make money even with diseases that are not as prevalent. And of course, it also depends the container and the closure that you're using. How do you actually package the drug product to get it to your patients? And of course, you know, with cellular therapy drug products, it's your actual blood, it's your cells. So how do you ship it all around the world to get it to different patients throughout the country? Or how do you get, you know, a patient in another country? And these are the kind of things that are being discussed now. And you guys are probably aware of the companies that are making these engineered T cells, Juno, Kite, and Novartis. They stopped their program, but in fact, their one product for leukemia, they're still getting into market sometime in 2017, 2018. These are all the things that they have to think about. Of course, environmental impact and validation and qualification of the manufacturing process and the facility. So, of course, with anything that you do, you have to qualify in terms of equipment, in terms of storage, and for the actual process, you have to validate, meaning that you have to ensure that when you have a process to manufacture a drug, it's validated. So, I mentioned good manufacturing practices. Good manufacturing practices came about due to this book by Upton Sinclair. I believe it was 1906, The Jungle. Now, back then, the meat that they were selling in Chicago, they found feces, rat parts, even human parts. And they were giving this and selling it to people. And this book really exposed the meatpacking industry back then. And because of that, everybody was outraged. So the government did what it had to do, and they enacted all these regulations. And really, the regulations for good manufacturing practices, the way that it's seen today, is really from 1978. CGMPs for drug and devices. And in the Code of Federal Regulations for the actual facility is 21 CFR 210-211, and in terms of quality is 21 CFR 820. And of course, anytime something happens, there's a new regulation or a new law enacted, as you can see from this list. So, I think for GMPs, I think I'm going to skip all this for the interest of time. But what I do want you to know about GMP is that you need special facilities. There's special regulations. 21 CFR 210-211 for the facilities. In terms of the phases of the clinical trial, a phase one, the GMP regulations, believe it or not, is not as strict as if you were doing a phase three trial. So they call this the step ladder or the ladder for GMPs or good manufacturing practices. And these are some other regulations. Don't worry about this. These are the components. And then this is what I was talking about the step progression of GMP, or good manufacturing practices. And this is from Lori Norwood, Deputy Director of the FDAC, the DMPQ or CPQ. And then, of course, you need something called a quality management plan, or quality control and quality assurance. And a lot of people are experts. There's whole conferences on quality management systems. So, I wanted to talk to you guys about ADA skidding. So this is an autosomal recessive disease. The incidence is in about 1 in 200,000 births. It's present at infancy. And typically, they have to treat it in the past, you would give a drug called PEG ADA, or you would do a bone marrow transplant. And about 1999 all the way to 2009-ish, there's been several groups. And the reason why gene therapy was really being done on this disease, even though it's rare, is because it's a monogenic disease, meaning that if you correct just one gene, you can cure a patient. And this is bubble boy disease, or one form of bubble boy disease. So how much does it cost? If you have SCIDs, ADA SCID, you're looking at $200,000 to $400,000 per year to just take this injection. It's expensive. As I mentioned, it's a monogenic disease. It's believed that a small number of corrective hematopoietic stem cells can be curative, and we know that this is true. Therefore, even if only a small number of cells receive the therapeutic gene, the patient may derive some benefit. So are you guys familiar with hematopoietic stem cells at all? Have you guys taken the course? Okay, so I'll skip this. So basically, these are progenitor cells or early living cells, and it's produced or it undergoes duplication inside the bone marrow, and then it differentiates into your common myeloid and common lymphoid progenitors, and then to all of these cell types here. In this trial, what we did is, as I mentioned earlier, we took stem cells from a patient. Once we took these stem cells, and these are marked by CD34, and only 1%, less than 1% of these CD34 positive cells are actually true stem cells. Most of them are progenitor cells. We take these stem cells from a patient. We took a retrovirus, Murine-Mahloney leukemia virus that was modified for our use. Then we mix these cells together, as you can see here, and we put it back into the patient. We treated about 20 patients over a span of 9 years, and I've left the institute since. But after that, they treated probably another 20 patients, and we did different types of regimens for this specific clinical trial. But something happened in about 2001. A similar trial in Europe, in the UK. One of the patients got what was theoretically thought is possible, but highly unlikely. At the time, 3 out of 10 patients doing something similar. But it wasn't ADA SCID, it was a different type of SCID, severe combined immune deficiency. And this patient actually got, 3 patients, got leukemia-like disease, meaning, and now we know what happened. Their vector inserted near the LMO2 gene, and when it did that, it actually caused these cells, and there's other factors involved as well. These cells, these patients actually ended up getting something, now we know it is leukemia, but at the time they were called leukemia-like symptoms. And so this really stopped clinical trials for cellular gene therapy here in the U.S. And so there was a good 3 years where clinical trials were for gene therapy was halted. And just to give you a little history, in the early 1990s, retroviral vectors were used to transfer normal human ADA cDNA to T cells collected by leukapheresis. Later, investigators started to use progenitors from the bone marrow. So you can either have mobilized stem cells or bone marrow stem cells or even cord blood stem cells. But these were bone marrow stem cells. In 1993, 3 infants who were diagnosed in utero had gene transferred to their umbilical cord blood CD34 positive cells, then reinfused, and then when the babies were four days old. And in fact, they've looked at these patients over time, and even though the gene that they transferred in, they could find it in their blood. So it actually did work. They transduced their stem cells, and it was long-lived. At the time, they didn't know that it was being silenced. Now they've actually made modifications, and I won't talk about that, but they did make modifications for that. In all cases, T cells with the normal gene were produced, but at levels too low to restore immunity. All subjects continued to receive PEG-88 enzyme and didn't receive any cytoreductive conditioning, and that's key as well. And minimal clinical benefit was seen. Long story short, here's a summary of the clinical trial that was done at the USC and then at UCLA. PEG-ADA, no busulfan, so no conditioning. And here we used two retroviral vectors, both with the ADA gene. In 2005, again, we're comparing two retroviral vectors. And then we took some of the patients off PEG-ADA because we thought that it would give the patient cell an advantage, a competitive advantage. And then we added busulfan. And then in 2009, this is when we really started to see results and getting essentially cures. When we removed PEG-ADA and we added busulfan. And here we added one retroviral vector. Three subjects were treated, and we were able to restore their immunity. And these are the vectors that were used. Don't worry about the vectorology. And so these were the changes that were made. And as you can see, if you look at the 200 series, and these are the different this is with PEG-ADA and no myeloablative conditioning, and here's with the removal. And as you can see, they have an immune system. This is ADA activity actually, but showing that they do have an immune system. In terms of transduction, meaning vectors integrated into the genome, as you can see clearly, we did get integration, so gene therapy, it worked. And now it's commonplace. At the time, it wasn't so common. And we published in 2012. So that's the other thing about doing clinical trials. It takes forever to publish. This is from 2001. That's when we treated our first patient. So 12 years to publish this one paper. So that is the end of my lecture. Takeaways, what you guys should know for the test, the phases of a clinical trial, knowledge that you need to prepare an IND, know about the chemistry, manufacturing, control section. For what you guys do is pretty important. But for the test, not so much. Know the challenges of getting an IND approved by the FDA. For example, the infrastructure required, the testing that's required. Thank you so much. Any questions?